The only chess all-rounder around the world from day one whose achievements are comparable to him is our own Jacques Kallis. If you look into the records books, chess cricket, batting, bowling, catches, look at Gary, look at Jacques. Jacques is, with him, emulating what he achieves.
Unreal.
That's a wonderful achievement from Gary Sobers, but also from Jacques Kallis, who, in South Africa terms, is not recognized for his greatness.
Welcome to The Biggest Man in Cricket, with your host, David Brooke.
That's Wes Hall.
Wes Hall.
I had a good relationship with him and Conrad Hunt, who died playing tennis in Sydney.
Yeah.
On the tennis court, died.
On the tennis court?
Yeah, he was the most wonderful person, Conrad Hunt. Yeah. He came and worked for us for about 5 years. Unbelievable person, Conrad Hunt.
Sure.
Opening batsman in their great team.
Dr. Bacher, it's to start off with, it's an absolute honor and a privilege.
No, my pleasure, my pleasure.
It feels like we're on our own South African cricket museum here. Thank you so much for welcoming us into your
home. My pleasure, my pleasure.
Firstly, how are you? We ask most of our guests how they are. Let's hear how Dr.
Look, I'm 84, going 85. The past 15 months, I've been in hospital 3 times. At one time, they thought I'd cancer the lung. Fortunately, it wasn't to be. So I've had various medical problems. But, you know, the man upstairs and I've got some very good doctors, specialists, physicians who look after me, and I've come through it well. I feel good. I've lost a lot of weight. I was about 89 kgs before I went into hospital the first time. I'm now down to 71, but I feel good. I feel good. I lead a normal life. My mind's good. Physically, I'm a bit limited, but life's still good for me, and I still want to do a lot of other things in my life. I'm not finished yet. I can tell you, I'm not finished yet.
What's on the card still for you? What are you like still? What's the ambition still?
Look, I've got to be mentally active. I meet a lot of people who age 65, 70, retire, and I meet them and say, oh, I'm so happy. No more stress, no more budgets to present. I'm happy. Go and have coffee. I'm not like that. My life goes on and I'm thinking day and night and I want to be proactive. This country's been terrific to me and my family, and if I can make a little contribution, I'm going to do it. And at the moment, I'm involved with Standard Bank in the city of Johannesburg. We've put together one multi-purpose sports complex in the heart of the city.
Oh, wow.
We wanted to put another 2. The budget there is about 33 million rand. And we'll make it happen. So I'm active. I get a lot of pride of what is around me. So life is good. I'm happy. I'm happy.
Incredible.
You know, people who go overseas and slate this country, they must have come near me, I'll tell you what. They must have come near me.
Was there ever a time that you said, no, I'm done with South Africa?
Never.
Australia's on the cards or something?
Never. Look, we've had tough times.
Yeah.
But look at the world today. The world's a mess.
Mm.
We're in a good place in South Africa. Let's keep it like that.
How would you describe Dr. Ali Bacher and your contribution to South African, not only cricket, but sport and history?
Look, I feel very fortunate. My late brother came from Poland in 1931. My late father came from Lithuania in 1929. Had they not come to South Africa, I would not be talking to you, because in 1940, the Nazi Germans slaughtered almost every Jew in those two areas. So they came here. They had no education. They had to go and work. They had 5 children. And all of us went to school and we taught ourselves. So, you know, life was tough then, but it was worthwhile. We had to be innovative. We had to have determination to make it good. And we did it good. My other 4 brothers and sisters all have done well. And this country's been very good to us. I'm so appreciative and thankful that this country offered so many opportunities to my family, being Jewish, and the history of Jewish people around the world since the Second World War has not been good. I mean, today, if you read the reports, anti-Semitism in the world today is at its highest since the Second World War.
Mm.
You go in South Africa, there might be a semblance of it, but it's not noticeable, it's not manifest. And Jews in this country remain as a minority group, like the Muslims, and due to the constitution, which is great, we've got protection under those rights. And I'm very thankful to be living in South Africa and for the administration who are in politics, who understand the constitutional rights of all South Africans.
Dr. Bakker, your original name is not Ali.
No, it's Aaron.
It's Aaron, right, which is a good Jewish boy's name. Tell us the origin of Ali. When you converted
it's extraordinary.
Into Ali.
We lived in Yeovil, and I had a very close friend. His name was Arnold Perkins. He died later. But every day, he had a small patch of green grass. The houses are small. We used to go play soccer there. And I got no idea. At age 8, he called me Ali. Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves. I don't know why. And it's extraordinary that even my late mother, from the age of 8, I was not Aaron, I'm Ali.
Yeah.
And Ali's a nickname. And I often go have trouble when I go to passports and that. They say, well, hello, are you Ali or Aaron? Ali, do you have a passport? I said, yeah. We don't.
Yeah.
So I've been Ali ever since. And, you know, my late mother was remarkable.
Mm.
She knew nothing about cricket. I mean, she came from Poland in 1931.
Mm.
And all of a sudden, I'm 17 and a half, 18, I'm starting to get a bit of notification in the newspapers. There might be a promising cricketer here. And she started to read it. She started to read it. And then I bought once The Art of Cricket by Sir Donald Bradman. He was my hero. He was the ultimate to me. And I met him.
Mm.
We can talk about it later. And I read his book, The Art of Cricket, as a kid. And one day, I couldn't find it. And my mother got hold of it, and she started to read it. And she started to underline. He said, don't hit in the air, hit on the ground. And she woke me up one morning to go through the book with her to read what Donald Bradman said.
She gave you some advice, like.
Yeah, it's just there's some wonderful stories by my late mother.
Mm.
So I'm playing for Transvaal, and I'm now captain, age 21.
Mm.
So my first game as captain is against Eastern Province at the Wanderers, Friday, Saturday, Monday. And she came to watch all 3 days, but she didn't know much about the game. So we're now in the Monday, the last day, and I need to declare to try and get a double innings victory.
Mm.
We're up on the first innings. And obviously I'm nervous. I'm in my first game. I'm not going to give it away to Eastern Province. I'm in trouble. So the crowd starts to heckle her, me.
Mm.
And she couldn't take it anymore, my mother. So at the Wanderers Cricket Stand,
like a good Jewish mother.
She was in the main stand. She walked out to the back of the stand, walked round, came where the players changed and called me out. And she gave me 1,000 words about declaring. So I went in the change room. I said, chaps, my mother says, we must declare. I'm going to declare now. And you know what happened? We had them 8 wickets down.
Yeah.
If I declared earlier, we would have won that match outright and we all would have won the championship.
Mm.
We were second to Natal by a couple of points. So if I'd listened to her earlier, who knows, we would have won
always
another.
Always listen to your mother.
Always would have won another curry cup.
Incredible. You kind of skipped over the part of that, where the love of cricket actually started. Like, where did it start for you?
No, on my mother's side, I don't know where they got it from, but her one brother was Aaron Nicol. He captained Balfour Park. He was a medium-fast in-swing bowler. He had a few games for Transvaal. And then her youngest brother played South African school soccer under 14.
Good.
So on my mother's side, the genes are there. That's where we got all the sport from.
Yeah.
My late father wasn't interested. There's a lovely story. My brother tells me, Izzy, that the game in Cape Town against Australia, the first test match, I'm captain now, So my late father, you know, he came from Lithuania. What did he know about protocol dress? So my brother tells me he comes to the Newlands. He's got tackies, short pants, a vest, and a handkerchief around his head against the sun. And he sits in an area very close to the member's stand.
Oh, wow.
You know, like with Jack and Tom. Yeah. And my late father is there. So my brother tells me this. One of the administrators came across to me, very nice. He said, look, you know, your dress, you know, it's not right, not right. And he then says to this chap, you see that person out there on the field? That's my son. And if you kick me out of here, I'm taking him off the field. They left him alone, and I carried on captaining South Africa.
My generation know you as an administrator. You know, growing up, we always knew Dr. Bachel was the main guy. He was the head honcho. He had control of the organization and took us through an insane time in South African cricket. But what was it like in your era playing with those kind of legends that you played with that we speak about today, where it's like there might not be any footage of it or there might be little footage of it, but you were there in that moment leading them, captaining them. They were these great players, but you were a great captain as well.
You know, it's to the benefit of the former great players that I played with, Russell Endine, Johnny Waite, Peter Heining, Neil Adcock, Keith Funston. We used to go to Cape Town on a train. We didn't fly. So I was in a compartment with these legends. I was still 18, 19, a youngster. And I used to listen. And I think so many of those journeys, trips, they had an impression in my mind. I listened, and I picked up some wonderful stories, wonderful tips about how to play cricket at the highest level. So when I got into provincial cricket, I was ready for it.
Mm.
I mean, I was playing Premier League cricket for Balfour Park when I was 15, 16, 17, against Peter Heine, Neil Adcock. I played against him when I was at school.
Mm.
The young cricketers, they don't have that, and that's a negative.
Mm.
So when I finished matric, I was ready for provincial cricket.
Mm.
I went right into Transvaal A, my third game, and that's carried on. And I think it's that grounding, playing tough cricketers still at school, hardened me, taught me. I learned a lot from it and was, you know, to my benefit for my future career as a cricketer.
Do you think that great captains are born with it, or do you think they can be trained?
You can't be trained, you're born with it. I mean, Jacques Cullis, one of the greatest cricketers the world has ever seen, in the words of Steve Waugh when I interviewed him in London, one of the greats of all time, if you made him captain, he'd leave the game.
Mm.
No interest. I liked, not captain, I liked leading people, motivating people, doing it quietly, subtly.
Mm.
As a young kid, when I was at primary school, I captained all the cricket team, the soccer team, the tennis team. That was me. I loved it. And before any provincial cricket match, you know, you got your team, nine players are doing well, they're there for life.
Mm.
And they're always one or two are borderline.
Mm.
A couple of bad games, they're out. And I used to focus on them subtly without them knowing, trying to give them confidence, build up their confidence so that they can succeed. And I like interacting with people. That was me. But as I said to Jacques Cullis, don't make him captain. My hero was Sir Donald Bradman. When I bought his book, The Art of Cricket, and my mother started to underline, don't do this, don't do that, he was my legend. And in 1970, thereabout, I wrote a letter to him. I was practicing medicine. I was a medical doctor. And I wanted to ask a few questions from him. They used to have the 8-ball over, why the 6-ball over? The no-ball law, when he played, was a bat foot rule.
Mm.
Now it was a front foot. And I sent the letter off to him. Within about 3 weeks later, I received an 8-page letter from him typed out, replying to me with all the questions. And when I think back, one of the most stupid things I ever did in my life, I read his letter. Rubbish, brother. Can you believe it?
Why?
Can you believe it? When I think back to these days.
It could be sitting right here, right behind me.
The legend of all times. But, you know, I met him in 1992. On the way to the World Cup, I stopped over in Adelaide with my wife.
Wow.
And he said, look, stop over, let's have a meal. And we went to his house, double-story house, taxi there. He opened the door, he went to Shira, opened the door, took it out, and we sat down for about 90 minutes just talking cricket.
Wow.
And the extraordinary part about him, he knew more about South African cricket than I did.
Really?
And that was a time where FW was in charge of the country. Are we going to move forward politically or not? And he was asking me all these type of questions. But he was an extraordinary person. And, you know, the world will never, ever have another cricketer like Sir Donald Bradman. He's probably the greatest sportsman of all sports in the 20th century. He was so much better than everybody else. You go into the history books, people like Len Hutter, Wally Hammond, Jacques Collis, et cetera, their test averages are all 57, 58, 56.
Mm.
He's 99.4. And look at that gap.
Unreal.
And I read an article once in the New York Times where they went through all the different sporting codes, the legends, Maradona, Pelé, all the different tennis players. And they came to the conclusion that Sir Donald Bradman almost certainly was the greatest sportsman of the 20th century.
The real GOAT. The real GOAT. the real greatest of all time. I mean, meeting Donald Bradman sounds completely out of this world. What does Donald Bradman's house look like?
It was a double-story house. You know, he never would play for money. He never accepted a cent for playing.
Really?
He was totally against it. He was an amateur. He became a stockbroker. He went to Adelaide. He was a successful person. But the stories about him are unbelievable, extraordinary. But it created division because he was a Protestant, and in the Australian team of those times, Bill O'Reilly, Jack Fingleton, they were Catholics.
Okay.
And there was a sharp division. I would think there was also a lot of resentment because in the 30s he was so dominant that wherever the team went, people just wanted to meet to Donald Bradman. Well, he wasn't knighted then, but he was legendary. And you read the stories and from what I gather, there was a lot of resentment against him. I'm sure a lot of it was jealousy because, I mean, he was a freak. The story goes that his first tour to England in 1930, at the Leeds Test match, he scored 300 at the end of the first day's play. Now, if you and I scored 300 on day one, what would you do that evening? You wouldn't go to bed right away, would you?
Yeah, no way. Definitely.
The story goes that he had his dinner, went upstairs, said cheers, and went to sleep. But he was a freak. He was a freak.
It's fascinating because Dave Rundle, who's Jacques Callis's manager, also spoke to us about kind of Jacques' mannerisms and how he would, you know, just be exhausted after a day's play where he scored a century, etc. In his final test match, he went to bed at 7:30 at night because he was exhausted, and he leaves it all out there on the field. But I wanted to ask you about Sir Donald. What was his take on South Africa returning? If you met him in 92, that was, you know, was that before the World Cup?
He was always pro South Africa. He had a very close relationship with the late Jack Cheatham. In the early 50s, we had a young South African cricket team under Sir Donald, under Jack Cheatham. And they were due to tour Australia, and there was a lot of talk, particularly from Australia, to cancel our team, the tour, because the strength was not good. It was a young team. And they went over, and they won two test matches. They drew that series 2-2. And he developed a very close relationship with Donald Bradman then. But Bradman was, I mean, he's just a legend. But You know, when he died, he made it a fact. He didn't want a big burial ceremony, a quiet passing away, which they did. He had one son, and his son changed his name because wherever he went, he just said, Bradman.
He's the son of Donald Bradman.
So he couldn't take it anymore.
Wow.
He changed his name, and I met his son in Australia once, and I think later in life there he reverted back to the name Bradman.
Oh, wow. Tell me about, you know, you obviously, you led some players, but I've always wanted to know, we just hearsay, how good were the likes of Graham Pollock and Barry Richards, in your opinion?
So when I met Sir Donald Bradman, I asked him how good was Graham Pollock. So he saw Graham Pollock play. There was the Adelaide Test match. Eddie Barlow got 200. Graham got about 180. We won that Test match under Trevor Goddard. So he saw him play. And all he said to me, he was better than Gary Sobers as a batsman. I said, what? He said, marginally. Although Gary was the greatest all-rounder of all time. So in 1970, our tour to England was cancelled. The following summer, Barry went to play for South Australia and had a whole season playing there. So Donald saw him play. And I said to him, how good was he? He said he was good as a Leonard Hutton, as a Jack Hobbs. And if you go to England, and when I always ask the older people who played the game how good they were, they say Len Hutton and Sir Jack Hobbs were the greatest English batsmen of all time, and he put them in that category.
Wow.
That's how good those two were.
You mentioned 1970. I want to ask you the moment and how did you hear about South Africa being kicked out of international
cricket? I knew we were gone. I mean, you know, the Labour government were in power then, and they made it very clear they would stop the cricket tour of England, because prior to that, the rugby team went there, and there was havoc, there was chaos. I mean, there's no way a test match for 5 days you can make sure that the protesters would invade the cricket ground. And I knew that tour was doomed. So I never had enthusiasm for it. And Harold Wilson stopped that tour. That was the end of it.
What was the... You obviously were leading the South African team at the... Not the Proteas, but the South African team at the time. You are the players would come to you for guidance, etc., as their captain. What was the talk amongst the players at that time?
Well, it was a mix, because some of the players played county cricket. Barry Richards, Mike Proctor, Lee Irvin. So they still had some form of... call it indirect international cricket. They could go to England and play against the great West Indian players. So it was hurtful for them, but it wasn't the end of their cricketing era. For the rest of them, South Africa, myself, you know, life goes on. That's history. Those are the facts. But I knew that we were doomed for a long, long time. 2 years later, we were due to go to Australia, and that tour was cancelled too, but I knew that tour would never take place.
At that point in time, did you envisage a next step in your career as a cricket administrator?
Right. I retired from provincial international cricket in 1974. But in the early part of the 70s, I was a young cricket administrator as well. Although I was captain Transvaal in South Africa, I was on the board of the Transvaal Cricket.
Okay.
So I became an administrator at a very early age. And in the 70s, we used to have board meetings once a month. And I used to go there and I used to listen. There was Eric Ryan, Jack Cheetham, Joe Pamensky, all these legend administrators. So for the whole of the 70s, I absorbed a lot of good things about cricket administration from these legends. So then in 1981, when I went full-time into cricket administration, I was ready for it. I'd had that experience in the 70s. And the person who gave me that opportunity was my late great friend Don Mackay Coghill, who died recently in Perth. He was Lee Irvin, one of my great friends for 60 years.
Mm.
And in 1981, I had my first bypass heart operation. I was driving near Ellis Park Rugby Stadium, and I had chest pain. And I phoned a friend of mine, a doctor friend, and I booked him to go into a private hospital. I knew what it was about. And what happened then was that we called in a physician, and he had me there for 2 days, and he came with the diagnosis that you got pericarditis. Now, pericardium is a little thin tissue around the heart, but it's not significant. And he said, look, go upstairs, we'll come up and sign you off, and you can go home. I was happy.
Mm.
About an hour later, somebody that I grew up with, John Benjamin, a cardiologist, we came from the same area. He heard I was in hospital. He came to see me. He listened to my story, and he said, Ollie, you better go see Professor John Barlow, who was the head of cardiology at Fitz University. And I went to see him, and I was due to go to England for a trip with Joe Pimenti and Jeff Dakin, and he wouldn't let me go. And he kept in there for a month, and there were no changes on the ECG. But he said, Ollie, I'm not happy, I'm not letting you go.
Oh.
And a month later, for the first time, on effort ECG, the ECG changed. And that was reflection of coronary artery disease. And that was a Thursday.
Mm.
And then on Monday, I had, I think, the third cardiac bypass operation in this country under at the J.G. Stratham Hospitals then. And I'll never forget it. I was terrified. Never had an operation before. Unheard of heart surgery. And it was a Monday. And I remember waking up about 11 o'clock that night, and I turned round and I saw the lights outside, and I realized I'd made it. God, that's got to be the best 30 seconds of my life.
Unbelievable.
Lucky person. If I'd gone home on pericarditis, there's no interview today, I can tell you that.
Well, that's an incredible story, and thank you to your specialist and your mate who really proved his worth that day.
Yeah.
We've had a couple of the guests now. We've had Alan Donald on the show. We've had Peter Kirsten. We've had Jimmy Cook, all talking about, some of them were later in their careers than others. You know, Alan Donald was still a youngster coming through, but the likes of Jimmy, Peter were older as we were coming back from isolation. Firstly, the one question I have for you, like, what did isolation actually mean? Like, in one or two sentences, what is, besides for being banned from international cricket, what else did it actually mean from a significance point of view?
Life goes on. You know, people say who, in the Second World War, some famous cricketers there lost 6 years of their prime time in a war.
Mm.
Some died. Hedley Verity from Yorkshire, brilliant left arm spin bowler in the 30s, got killed in the war. So you know, those people suffered more than we suffered.
Mm.
Life goes on. You know, tomorrow's another day, and you just get on with your life and do as best you can. There's no use reflection on sulking or moping. Life goes on.
Alan Donald credits you for him not representing England. He said that he phoned you because he was always honest with you. And he said that he's had a little approach from Alan Lamb and the English to say, how about qualifying for England? And he credits you to say that one phone call, and you said to him, please just hold on. We are coming back into international cricket.
No.
At that time when Alan phoned you and asked you about that, what was going on? Was it the truth that we were coming back, or were you just positive about it?
Look, once the ANC were unbanned. And I, for various reasons, developed a very strong relationship with the late Steve Shwety. He was very close to Thabo Mbeki. And we were good personal friends. He came to two of our my kids' weddings there. I adored Steve. And I got to know where they were coming from. And there was no question that under the ANC, who all along said, if you have one non-racial sporting body in this country where all South Africans can participate, we will give you our support to go back internationally. And Thabo Mbeki kept his word. I mean, in 1991, there was no guarantee that there would be democracy in 1994, no ways. But he kept his word, Thabo Mbeki. And when we went to England and went to India, he said, we've kept our promise, non-racial, one body, back in international cricket. And it's unbelievable that we went to India in November 91. There was no guarantees. I mean, who knew that in 1994 there would be democracy in this country? There was turmoil in this country. So I've got to give a lot of credit to the late Steve and to Thabo Mbeki in particular, who kept his word.
There's a little rumor that I heard once of the, and you can tell me if it's true or not, that before you, I think it was, you were going to England, you needed to get a letter from the ANC or from Thabo Mbeki or one of them to confirm that they had actually, just can you take us through that? Is that true?
No. So the important letter which I needed was a letter from Thabo Mbeki on behalf of the ANC telling the ICC, look, we now support South Africa's readmission back into world cricket for the following reasons. So I had to get this letter. So my son David and my daughter Lynn, we went to Hillbrow and we had to go into a flat, the 21st floor, to get the letter, which was crucial, from Thabo Mbeki. I can't take heights.
Oh, well.
I mean, down the years, when I go into a hotel, I said, I'm on the ground floor, first floor. Otherwise, I'm going to another hotel.
Really?
Lifts are not working. I need that letter. So my daughter and my son, we go up to the 7th floor, and I'm finished. I mean, I can't. I'm going to die, man. So they put me down on the floor, and they go up to the 21st floor. They knock on the door, I'm told. I think Joe Slover was there. Thabo Mbeki was there. They gave him the letter. They came down to the 7th floor. I'm still lying down flat. They picked me up. We went down the stairs. We went to the airport. I met Steve Shwety there, and I took the letter, which got us back into world cricket.
That is an unreal story.
I'm at 21st floor.
So it's nice that your two of your children are part of history.
Absolutely, we're history.
These days, you just send an email and now it goes out. It would have made your life a lot easier without having to go up to the
21 floors. Good God,
that's a great story. Just, you know, once it all kind of, where were you? Can you remember that moment where you heard that we were being allowed back into cricket and how then you communicated it back to the...
We asked for hours discussion with the ICC. So Jeff Dakin, Chris McAdish, myself and Steve, we went to London. We made our presentation. But it was a fait accompli. Once the ANC said it's okay, we were back. But interestingly enough, the West Indies abstained. Why did they abstain? Because they said to us, look, there's so many different islands who represent the ICC. We can't make a statement supporting you unless we get endorsement from all the islands. They couldn't physically do it, so they abstained. But we all went to Dubai. All around the world, the meeting lasted 40 minutes, man, and we were back in world cricket. And to this day, you got to give credit to the ANC, and in particular to Thabo Mbeki and Steve Shwety.
Must have been an incredible moment. Can you, when you phoned your wife, and what did you say to her?
She was there in London. They were
okay.
No, there was a celebration, cocktail party. I don't know, but
yeah,
things were moving so fast there, and it was a privilege, you know, to be part of it.
Good things
were happening.
Yeah,
we had our 21 years of isolation. Now the door was opening up, and then out of nowhere, we go to India. India in November of 1991. Now, India left South Africa in 1948. As soon as the Nationalist Party came to power, apartheid, they left this country. They were the first country to get out. All of a sudden now, we're back in world cricket, but where do we go for our support before that meeting? We go to India. Unheard of. And they gave us their support. But once again, it was only because the ANC, Thabo, Steve, they endorsed us, their support for our remission back into world cricket.
We've kind of skipped over the period of the rebel tours. If I can just ask you briefly about what that meant and what it did to there was differing opinions, whatever side you were on. But you were running that.
I've never denied that I was a key component of that. At that time, you know, my rationale was that apartheid was here for life. I was so wrong. We will therefore be banned, isolated for life. I was wrong. And we needed to, and me in particular, being a full-time Creed administrator, needed to keep the game alive to a certain extent. And that was the start of how that those tours came to the fore. On reflection, and it's easy to say on reflection, knowing the anguish, the hurt that it caused the majority of South Africans, mainly black South Africans, on reflection, I think I would have thought twice about those tours, but that's in hindsight.
It's interesting that you say that, because you're a very positive gentleman and you've obviously wanted South Africa to come back, but you thought at one time we were never coming back and
I was wrong.
Yeah.
I was wrong.
To be able to be in that situation, I can't imagine it was easy. So thank you for sharing that with us.
Okay.
Let's get on to more positive things. That 92 World Cup, well, maybe not so positive, but that 92 World Cup, we've spoken to a couple of the guys, and it really, it was more about like when we came back there. But tell me, you know, Adrian Caper told us stories about the change room, etc., incredible stories. But what was going on? You had to do the cocktail parties and the suits and those kind of meetings in the president's suite and all of those kind of meetings. What was South Africa? Where were we positioned? Were we the darlings of cricket, or were there still people skeptical?
There was such enthusiasm, passion, that South Africa were back in world cricket. I did a smart thing. I took Steve Swetty with me to the World Cup. And, you know, he's a likeable person, or was a likeable person, pragmatic. Evidently, you know, he spent 15 years in Robben Island. And Madiba once told me that he was a tough nut. He had to calm him down to say, listen, when South Africa's normal, you're not going to kill the whites. Those days are gone. This country's for all South Africans. We've got to get everybody together. And Madiba calmed Steve down.
Okay.
Steve, from what I gather, was a tough nut. You know, he was after the Nationalist Party and all their policies there. So I went with him on this trip. And it wasn't the only trip I'd been with him. I'd been with him to London two or three times. And I'll never forget one trip we went from London to Birmingham. It was a two-hour train trip. And England were playing the West Indies in a one-day match at Birmingham. And for 2 hours, he just spoke to me about his time in Robben Island. I think he said, for whatever reason, They put him in a solitary confinement. I think it was for about 20 hours a day.
Sure.
Dark room. No window, nothing.
Mm.
And then they'd let you out, and as he opened the door, you'd swirl around and he'd fall over. And he was subject to that punishment, call it punishment, for 9 months, 12 months, doesn't matter. And when I got to Birmingham, he doesn't know to this day, I went into the change room there, the dressing room at the station there, and I started to vomit. I mean, what he told me, the experience there for 15 years. And, you know, he survived it, Madiba survived it, Mbeki survived it. And to their credit, they never looked for retribution.
Mm.
They wanted to make sure that South Africa became a non-racial country for all South Africans, equality for all, and they've kept their word.
When was your first interaction with Nelson Mandela?
So we're now in London, and we get approval back in the ICC. No tours, but we're back as members. I meet at the career ground for the first time, Clive Lloyd. God bless him, news figure. So I said to him, look, things have changed in our country. Why don't you come back to South Africa? Come to South Africa. Terrific. So I arranged August that year to come to South Africa. And I took him into the townships, and then almost the second day he said to me, I want to meet Nelson Mandela. So I phoned Steve, and he arranged the next day, Shell House, same place where the ANC is today, top floor, go there, and we're waiting to see Nelson Mandela. And behind us was a Swedish delegation of journalists come to meet the great man. And the door opened. And he saw Steve, he saw me, and he saw Clive Lloyd. And he said, Steve, bring your two creators here with me. So we went there, and the journalists followed. And we just spoke for about 3 minutes, and somebody must have briefed him, because he said to him, Ollie, I believe you people are doing nice work in the Times, please carry it on. And then one of the Swedish journalists said, what about South Africa playing in the World Cup? And he said, of course they must. It went round the wires that day. The next day I got a phone call from the president of Sri Lankan cricket. He said, it's nonsense. You're going to the World Cup. We arranged a meeting in Dubai. Everybody came for a 40-minute meeting, and that's how we got back into world cricket. And that was the power of Nelson Mandela. Nobody wanted to could say no to him. I mean, he was the most extraordinary person I've ever met. I mean, he always said, when you have tragedies like this, remember, you can forgive, but don't ever forget, because if you forget, it'll happen again.
You had a storied and long relationship with Madiba. Just some of your, besides for that momentous moment, just some of your, but like more funnier stories that you maybe can remember from Madiba that you can share with us.
Two stories, okay. So it would have been 1992. It was February 1990. And we had a triangular tournament at the Wanderers. We invited the West Indies, Pakistan and South Africa. And we got knocked out. So the final was between West Indies and Pakistan. And I phoned Steve and I said, Steve, look, be nice, Madiba, come to the cricket. He came, never ever watched a cricket match ever before, first time. So it's now tea time, and I say to him, I say, Mr. Mandela, I think the players there would love to meet with you. Would you like to go see him? Sure. So we went round the back and lined up the players. He shook hands with all of them. And then I said to him, Mr. Mandela, we can go back the same way, or we can go onto the field around the rope, main stand up to there. He said, Ollie, let's do that.
Mm.
So we go. We go down the steps, we turn right, and I'm on his right-hand side.
Mm.
And then, after about 10, 15 yards, a white South African jumps over the fence and throws an orange at him.
Sure.
Never been reported. And to my credit, I caught it with my right hand.
No worries.
And we just carried on walking. Got to the main stand, got up to the ground, to the VIP area, and I said to his main security person, I said, did he see that orange thrown at him? He said, of course. I said, why didn't he react? He said, he wasn't going to give that person the credit to show that he unnerved Nelson Mandela.
Wow.
He saw it. Wow. I mean, I caught it, I promise
you. The skills were still there.
So that was the one story. And then, the next story is, we got the Rugby World Cup, 1995.
Nice.
And on the Friday, he goes public that he's going to support the Springboks, to wear the Springbok jersey. Now, within the ANC, that's a death message.
Mm.
Because the ANC supporters couldn't play for South African rugby because they were black.
Mm.
So, 8 o'clock news that night, the Friday night, Mandela's message, and then my message. And I said, look, we respect him enormously, but you know that Springbok emblem is the kiss of death for our new people that we support. He don't create, can't have it. We'll just call it England playing South Africa, Australia, not the Springbok creators. 9 o'clock the next morning, I get a phone call. Mandela. He says, Ali, what are you doing on Monday? I said, nothing. He said, why don't you come have lunch with me? I've worked out that he's seen what I said. So on Monday, we go to Union Buildings, and I took the late Percy Son and the late Julian Thornton with me, two board members, to come with him. So we have lunch, and there's some wine. I think the next day was his birthday. We go outside, and he says, chaps, you want to know why I said this? I said, yeah. He said, look, I'm the first black president of this country. The Afrikaners love rugby. And I know how important the Springbok emblem is to them. So I'm going to let it go because I know that they will support me thereafter. Couldn't argue. And I was at the rugby final. And it's a beautiful story about told to me by Steve Shwetty. He says, at 11 o'clock that day, Madiba phones him and says, bring me a Springbok number 6 rugby jersey. So Steve says to him, why? Just bring it. And I'm told by Joel Stransky that day at about 2:30, there's a knock on the change room door. A security guard says to Morne Duplessis, the president would like to come and see the players. He went in and evidently he wore Francois Pienaar's number 6 rugby jersey.
Mm.
And he went up to every one of them quietly and everybody told him how important it is for you to win for South Africa. And I was there. And when he walked onto that field with the rugby Springbok jersey, you could have heard the noise in Zimbabwe, I can tell you. And he turned in no time.
Mm.
Particularly the Afrikaner on his side. And he was a legend. I mean, an unbelievable person, one of the greatest people of the 20th century.
In your one-on-ones that you are no doubt had with him, did he have a love for cricket? Did he understand?
But he came to support it. And he used to get his PA to phone me 10 minutes before he was at the Wanderers. Not 3 days, 10 minutes. He said, the president will be there 10 minutes. So he rushed around to organise everything, go and meet him. The first thing he did, you know the first thing he did? He went to where the catering was. Black people.
Mm.
He first went there to say hello to him. You can't believe the noise.
Mm.
They couldn't believe. That's what he did.
Mm.
And then I lined up all the dignitaries and we start one by one. And he'd have a famous saying that, "You might not remember me, but my name's Nelson Mandela." And he'd shake the hand. I mean, he was unbelievable, extraordinary person. He just had that
Madiba magic.
Yeah, touch. We adored him, loved him.
Was there ever a time that that you used that Madiba magic where you knew that a decision needed to be made at some point that you needed to make, but a little bit of Madiba magic would go a long way?
So we're now 1998. There's a tournament in Bangladesh. And we won the final against the West Indies. The West Indies team now going to London and they due to fly for a 5-test tour of South Africa. They're not getting on a plane. There's a problem they have with their board. It's about money. They're not coming to South Africa. They're in a hotel in London and that is it. I get a phone call. So I phone Jace Kerbal. Now, Jace Kerbal loved cricket passionately, was Madiba's right-hand man, and we had a wonderful close relationship. So I phoned Jace and I said, "Jace, I've got this problem. Leave it to me." So about an hour later, delivered to me is a letter sealed for the West Indies cricket team from Nelson Mandela. I don't know what's in the letter. So I go to London now, and this team are not moving. They're 2 days, they're not getting out of the hotel. They're not coming to South Africa. I then get a phone call from one of the journalists to say, one of the key players has come to address the media.
Mm.
You might want to come and speak to him. So I ran across with this letter and I gave it with Courtney Walsh, tall bloke, and I gave it and said, "Look, when you got a moment, just read it. It's a letter from Nelson Mandela." They caught the plane the next day. And what happens is that I'm told by the West Indies players, they had a meeting about 2 o'clock in the morning. And they opened this letter. And it was a letter from Nelson Mandela telling them why it's important for them to come to South Africa. They caught the plane the next day back to South Africa.
I remember that story.
That was his magic, his power. Nobody would say no to him.
Incredible. Just take me through some of those early tours when you know you were team manager, etc., but you were running the UCB at the time. Just in terms of like some of those players coming through, a young Hansie Cronier, those kind of guys that were coming through. All of a sudden, we were getting into the professional era of cricket. When did you know that world cricket had changed from amateur into full-on professionalism?
I think the key supporter of that change was David Richardson, the wicketkeeper.
Mm.
There was a meeting in Durban in the early 90s, and I was asked to attend there, and you know, David was a lawyer, but he was also pretty straight and blunt, and he made it very clear that we're entering a new professional era. People will lose their jobs. They need to be employed full-time, paid by cricket, so that they can live and play cricket. And I think he was a key person.
Yeah.
And from that moment on, I mean, we started to go professional. I think David had a key place in motivating to me the need to advance, to move from an amateur status to a professional status. And that was David Richardson.
Interesting. He's actually, I never knew how much he played. I know he became a great administrator in the ICC level as well afterwards, but I never realized his role that he played there. Hansie Cronier, you know, when I mention the name Hunter Krinier. I mean, we all, the story of Hunter Krinier, the scandal, etc. Firstly, when did you first come across Hunty, and what was your opinion of him when you first saw him play? Let's say that.
Look, I had a close relationship with Evie Cronier's father, who was on the board with me, and I just became a supporter of Free State cricket. They were still on the periphery, but I saw Corrie van Zyl, I saw Alan Donald, I saw Hunty Cronier, and I saw a huge potential there. So I got close to their cricket, and I saw in Hunty, born leader. We spoke about leaders born or not born. No, he was a born leader. He was a motivator. There's no question about it. And he became the youngest South African cricketer to captain a provincial team. I think he was 20, I was 21. So I was a big supporter of Hunty Cronier. He was a very good leader, very good motivator. His batting, he was a good batsman. He wasn't a great batsman. I think his test average is about 37. But he had the players behind him, there's no question about it. He led from the front. And, you know, it's a tragedy what happened, what money can do to anybody, I suppose. Change your belief, change your views. And they changed Hunty Cronier, where money became, you know, his key component.
When it all went downhill, did you feel a sense of betrayal?
I felt let down. I mean, I'll never forget, we invited the Australian chairman CEO to come to South Africa. We were having a 3-day tournament just for goodwill. PR, the relations between ourselves and Australia were not good. And I brought them over and said, come on, let's get together, let's sort it out. And we went to a private game park in KwaZulu-Natal. And I remember about 3 o'clock in the morning, I got a phone call from Gulam Rajo. To say, Hunty wants us to, the captain wants to speak to you. And I think all he said was, Doc, because on the Friday before, there was news in India about Hunty and bookmakers.
Mm.
And Gulam said, look, he wants to speak to you. And he took the call and he just said to me, Doc, I'm sorry, I've let you down. I haven't been honest with you. And I put down the phone and then I phoned Percy Son. I said, Percy, you better come over here now. He says, I'm coming. I said, don't you dare come, because 6 months before, in that private game park, I think an American had gone out in the middle of the night for a walk and got killed by a lion. Stay. And that's how it all broke.
And then the damage control afterwards. You know, how do you... That's not something that they teach you in the manual, how to be a cricket administrator. But your experience took us through that stage.
Look, it was now out of our hands. It became a government issue. It became an international issue.
Mm.
There was a former judge was asked to preside over a court to go through the do's and don'ts, where South Africa were involved and not involved.
Mm.
That was a terrible time. I mean, I got death threats in India and Pakistan because I had to go public and be honest and tell them what I'd heard of when I toured India and Pakistan in previous years. All the time there was that smell that something's not right, that players are getting paid to manipulate the game.
Mm.
And I was proved correct later down the years.
Just take us through, you know, some of, we're back now in international cricket, some of the great test, and I want to talk test cricket, some of the great test cricket victories that you've been privileged to see around the world, and those impacts that our players have had on world cricket.
Well, I think about my own career, you know, I played 12 test matches. I was privileged. We had a very strong team. We played Australia 9 times.
Mm.
I often remind Ian Chappell that we won 7 of the tests. The 8th test was at the Wanderers. It rained on the last day. We would have won that one too. So they only beat us once at in Cape Town. So every time I go to Australia, the first thing I tell the Australians, do you remember what happened when your team came to South Africa twice? So we annihilated them.
Yeah.
So that to me is, you know, when I think back of my career, my only negative is that I never scored 100 in Test cricket. I think I'd be honest to say to myself that in provincial cricket, you know, I scored 100 against Neil Adcock, against Peter Pollock, Mike Proctor, and there were probably better bowlers that I played in international cricket, but it wasn't to be. So you can't have everything in life, but if I got one little regret, that I didn't have a Test century. But South African cricket there in 1970, I mean, we beat the Australians 4-0. They still have never, ever been whitewashed like that 4-0 in any Test series. And had there been a fifth Test match in Port Elizabeth, it would have been 5-0. And to give you an idea how strong that team was, in the third Test match of the Wanderers, in the second innings, I changed the batting. I got Eddie Barley, who was batting 5, to go open with Barry Richards. I was 3, Graham was 4. 5 was Lee Irvin, 6 was Tiger Lance, 7 was Dennis Lindsay, 8 was Mike Proctor, batting number 8.
Unreal.
And number 9 was Trevor Goddard, and number 10 was Peter Pollock, who could bat, and number 11 was Trikos, who was a brilliant slip catcher. I mean, that was a formidable team. But people say that was our best ever South Africa team. I don't think so. I think the, if one is objective, I think the best performance effort by a South African cricket team is Graham Smith's team in 2008. They went to England, they won their 2-1. They went then to Australia and they won the series in Australia. And no South African team has ever, ever gone to England, Australia in the same year and won both times. So I'm sure I'm correct when I say that in my opinion, trying to be rational and honest, I think that probably is South Africa's best ever cricket performance.
And what, you know, you obviously, I mean, Graham is an incredible leader. When you see him now running with SA20, did you see when you turned a great administrator, great cricketer to great administrator, there's a little bit of synergy there between Graham's career, playing career, and turning into a great administrator.
Look, I think, you know, he will always be remembered as the only Test captain in the world to have captained his national team for over 100 Tests. I mean, that is unbelievable. You know, his record is unbelievable. And as an opening batsman, he averaged about 48. So on the field of play and as a cricket administrator, they don't come better than Graham Smith. He can be very proud of what he's achieved.
What's your relationship like with Graham back when he was playing and these days?
He's Cape Town. Well, we hardly interact. There's no problems.
Yeah.
You know, he left Joburg.
Yeah.
He went to King Edward's bicycle. There was a reason why he left Joburg. He can tell you why. Somebody wasn't honest to him in Transvaal cricket, and he called a day and went to Cape Town. So we don't interact, but he can be very proud of what he's achieved.
Incredible, Dr. Bakker. When was the time where you said? I mean, I know you're still doing community with, as you said earlier, in the city and Standard Bank, etc. When was the time where you said, okay? Or did the family call time on your cricket administrative career?
Life is interesting. There are many people that I know who did well in business or in sport and but stayed too long and eventually get booted out. I think one thing that I did well, I knew when to get out. I never was in a position where the board said to me, Ollie, cheers. I made that call on every occasion. In 1974, I knew it's time to call a crit in first-class cricket. I had 14 years at the top, gone. I made that decision. And then I went into cricket administration in 1981. In 2003, I ran the World Cup in South Africa. I made that decision, my call, South Africa, get out. So I'm happy about that there. And as I said to you, so many people, you know, they eventually get booted out and then they become bitter and angry. You know, life's not like that, you know. Today you're a hero and tomorrow the next person comes around and he takes your place. And you've got to accept that. And fortunately, many sportsmen I know, not only in cricket, went on a bit too long, eventually got booted out and became bitter and angry about their fate.
Dr. Bakker, I can't leave today without Sir Garfield Sobers passed away in the last days, and we are here today. Just give us your I know you had a special relationship with him. Just give us a little bit of a memorial for him.
Yes, we had a very close relationship with him. Gary Garfield, I call him Gary. He's certainly the greatest cricketer this world has ever seen. There can be no question about it. He was a 5-in-1 player. He bowled left arm quick, left arm medium. He bowled left arm spin. He was a brilliant slip catcher, and he was a majestic left-hand batsman with a test average of about 57. So he was a 5-in-1 package. But he was pretty unique. He didn't believe in team talks. Didn't believe in it.
Wow.
He didn't believe in net practices. he said he could play golf. He was a scratch golfer, and that would relax him for a cricket match. And he didn't like a lot of sleep. Evidently, he slept 3-4 hours. That's all he needed.
Wow.
So he was a unique genius. And he's 89, and we had a very, very warm relationship with him. And this morning, I was just going through his life, and our tour to Australia was cancelled in 1971-72. And so Donald Bradman, who was in charge then, organized the rest of the world against Australia. And it was a test match. And it was January the 1st at the Melbourne Cricket Ground. And he got a duck in the first innings. He got 254 in the second innings. And Sir Donald Bradman writes, he's almost certain that that was the best ever batting performance ever seen in Australia, 254. He was a genius, Gary Sobers, and a lovable person, never made any money out of cricket, loved his golf, he loved South Africans. He had a very warm relationship with the late Tiger Lance. They got on beautifully. He came out here for our unification banquet. He was our guest of honor. And I remember before the banquet, we had a special day in Soweto at the Alcon Stadium. It was warm, it was beautiful. And I also invited Cyril Gavaskar to come out for this important day. And I got Gary to bowl spin to Cyril Gavaskar in the nets, and the cameras were there, went around the world. And that was a change in South African cricket. So he was party to it, he supported, and he loved South Africans. And I had huge respect for him. And when I went to London, many times we'd meet and you know have a cup of tea together. One of the greats, if not the greatest cricketer of all time.
Incredible. Thank you for sharing that. It's a beautiful tribute to him. And well, as you say, arguably the greatest cricketer of all time. And it's quite apt that we are talking here today.
It's interesting that the only test all-rounder around the world from day one whose achievements are comparable to him is our own Jack Cullis. If you look into the records books, test cricket, batting, bowling, catches, look at Gary, look at Jacques. Jacques is with him, emulating what he achieves.
Unreal.
That's a wonderful achievement from Gary Sobers, but also from Jacques Cullis, who in South Africa terms is not recognized for his greatness.
We spoke about that with Dave Randall.
He's one of the greats of all time. I mean, I interviewed Steve Waugh in London, and I asked him about Jacques Cullis. He said, one of the greatest cricketers of all time. And I remember saying on TV, "Are you sure?" He said, "Ollie, listen to me, one of the greats of all time. In South Africa, we do not recognize him for that, which is very sad and very unfair."
Mm. It's honestly, we could talk for the whole day. But we have a special guest here today, and this wasn't planned. I saw him from the side of my eye there coming in. But it is very apt that your grandson, Jaron, is here. If we can get Jaron maybe in the shot.
Come, Jaron. Chat to him in a little while. He's lovely.
Yeah, we're going to chat now.
He knows how to handle people.
So Jaron is your grandson, yeah. And he's a young cricketer coming through the ranks. Firstly, how special is that for you?
Well, there's a change because David's father and him, they first lived in Joburg.
Mm.
And I remember when he won't remember when I used to go to their place, throw the ball to him, primary school, high school, always around, careful not to push him, but just throwing balls and trying to get him interested.
Mm.
And you know, he was a joke then, man. I remember what school were we at?
Was at Bishops.
I mean, he's Bishops, I go and watch him one game. He's batting about number 8, 9, 7, I don't know. So I'm happy to look at him. He's just chirping away there, not talking about the game. Goes out to bat. He's out in 3 balls. He wants to hit a 6 right away. Comes off, takes the bat, and he's chirping away. And I say, I mean, get focused, man. You can't play like this. And something happened.
Yeah.
In his last term of matric, I've asked David, I've asked him, something changed.
Mm.
He started to take the game seriously.
Mm.
And he's got possibilities.
Yeah.
He knows the history of cricket. You speak to him, I promise you won't.
Really?
You won't get the better of him on predecessors, the game, what's happening in world cricket.
I don't think he's got a choice. He's the grandson of the great.
And he's now contracted with the Titans. Let's see what he can develop. I've got confidence in him. He's very unusual.
Mm.
People don't know whether he's batting off break, leg breaks.
Mm.
But it's in his mind, but he knows the game. He reads about the game. He listens, he hears. And for a young kid, he's fully familiar about the great game of cricket. Have a chat with him.
Jaron, thanks for popping in. It's wonderful to meet you. I've heard about you, but... Firstly, I mean, just like, how is it to be sitting here with the great? I mean, he's your grandfather,
yeah,
but he's a legend.
It's incredibly special, and these are the stories that I grew up listening to.
Mm.
And without a doubt, this relationship I have with my grandfather and all of these stories definitely catapulted my love for the game.
Mm.
And he's absolutely right when he talked about the phrase is unseriousness for the sport. I mean, I always enjoyed playing it, but I never really had ambitions to make it as a professional until quite late. So I think that was mainly a credit to myself actually being quite an average cricketer.
Mm.
I started off with my school's third team when we entered open cricket.
Mm.
And only in matric I really broke through into the first team. I've always had a bit of a unique action. Mm. I've got hypermobility in all of my joints. Mm. And I've got a hyperextension which allows me to bowl a Dusra.
Mm.
And it somewhat emulate Muralitharan's action. He's my hero. I actually got to meet him when I was in India a few months ago, and I was able to have many long chats with him, which was incredible. He's probably my greatest inspiration as a cricketer. And I've heard stories about him through my grandfather, and I've been so fortunate to have these sorts of experiences in the last few months. It all happened so quickly.
Mm. We're going to have you on as in your own episode in a couple of years' time, so when you've made it.
He sends me 3 months ago, an email with a picture with him and some Indian creator. I don't know the Indian. So I go back to him, "Jaron, who's that chap?" MS Dhoni.
Just some Indian chap.
The two of them have a chap.
Unreal, eh?
On the field, MS Dhoni.
I wish you could have seen your grandfather's face when you were talking. He's just beaming like a typical proud grandfather, not the great Dr. Ali Bakker, the cricket administrator. Listen, we're going to wrap up, Dr. Bakker. I just want to say thank you from the bottom of my heart from our team, and from our team, and I thank you for welcoming us. And we're going to take some shots of what's around us here. It is a special pleasure. You're a special human being.
Yeah. Let's Thank you. Let's go.
Let's go.
Spend time here.
Thank you.
A pleasure. Tell me when.